I'm delighted to welcome back to the program Kirk Ellis. He's Emmy Award-winning writer and co-executive producer of the HBO series John Adams. He is chair of the Santa Fe Arts Commission. He's vice president of the Western Writers of America. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Always a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you, and we must tell people that starting tonight, Thursday, the entire HBO series, John Adams, is going to be screening as a marathon starting today, also on Sunday and also Wednesday of next week, so people will have the opportunity to see it.
That's right, and I should just clarify that. It's not a marathon each night of the entire 7 episodes. We are showing episodes 1 and 2 tonight at 7 o'clock, and we're showing episodes 3, 4, and 5 on the 6th, and the final two episodes on the 9th, and the screenings on the tonight, the 3rd and the 9th, will also be accompanied by Skype interviews with principal talent.
Nice.
Tonight we'll have production designer Gemma Jackson, who coincidentally is also the production designer of Game of Thrones, and the costume designer Donna Zakowska talking about their work on the miniseries.
Excellent. And it's free?
It is indeed. It is a free screening, thanks to George R. R. Martin and the wonderful folks at the Cocteau.
Excellent. Well, we have talked on the 4th of July or near the 4th of July about all kinds of things, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the founding of our country. But we've never really talked all that much about John Adams himself. How did you come to get involved in this series? And what was your interest in John Adams?
I actually got the book as a Christmas present from my wife the year it was published. And I'm thinking that that book was actually published in 2000 or 2001. And it's very difficult sometimes to read a book for pleasure when you work in the field of historical dramatization. But I did, and I thought David McCullough is a wonderful writer, very dramatic in his own telling of a story. And it was a fascinating account of an individual who, up to that time, had been mostly forgotten by history. As David said, he had the misfortune to be sandwiched between two tall, handsome Virginians on either side of his presidency, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. And at some point, inevitably, I said, boy, you know, this would make a really great miniseries. But at the time, the book had been optioned. Ridley Scott's company had it. And amazingly to me now, they were going to do it as a 4-hour movie for CBS. I have no idea what story they were planning to tell at that point. But the movie didn't get made, and the rights reverted back to David, and then Tom Hanks bought the rights through his company Playtone for HBO. Tom and I had worked on another project together that hadn't gone a full term, and I got a hold of his office and said, I don't know who you're contemplating to write this script, but boy, I would love to have the opportunity to talk to you about it. And we discovered we had very similar ideas that were all about the fact that because John Adams was somebody not as famous as many of his contemporaries, he was sort of the perfect person to take modern audiences through the Revolution, because in many ways he was an everyman.
And he was flawed. He was not this sort of handsome, charismatic person. He was a complex person. He was, and this is something that probably many people don't know, a very fair person who actually defended the British side of the Boston Massacre.
That was one of the big revelations in David's book, that the man who would go on to become our second president began his career, really, defending the British soldiers accused of the so-called Boston Massacre and winning that case, by the way. He was a person who believed that America should be a country of laws, not men. That's a famous statement of his that he iterated on many occasions. And that every man, no matter how heinous the crime of which he is accused, was entitled to a fair trial. And so he did not hesitate to put his reputation, his family's welfare, even their own well-being and safety in colonial Boston on the line for that principle. Now, it should be said, because you've talked about Adams's complexity, there was that principled part of him that believed, yes, this was absolutely the right thing to do. I'm outraged that no other barrister in Boston will leap to these men's defense. On the other hand, Adams was a vain man in many ways, and I think he saw it was a very, very explosive case that, properly played, could make his reputation. And in that sense, he was right.
And there's this kind of dialogue ongoing throughout the series between him and his wife, Abigail Adams, in which, in that particular case, she says something to him like, are you trying to win your case or are you trying to make rhetorical flourishes?
That's correct. That's correct. You're talking about a scene in episode one that's one of my favorite scenes in the show. It's where Adams gives Abigail his summation speech to read for the prisoner's defense. And those of us who are in long-term relationships often give our significant other this material, hoping the response is going to be extremely positive. Often, that is not the result we get. And Abigail says to him, John, you've overburdened your argument with ostentatious erudition, which is another way of saying this bloody thing is overwritten. You just need to be as simple as possible and state the case clearly for people. You don't need to show you're a great orator by quoting other ones.
The role of Abigail Adams is such an interesting one because you know that she would have been probably a president herself in a different era. She was a very powerful person, a very intelligent person, an advisor to her husband, very politically savvy, and it's just a testament to those times that she didn't have even the ghost of an opportunity.
Yeah, the story of John Adams really isn't the story of a single man. It's the story of a really remarkable couple, John and Abigail. They had one of the most astonishing marriages in American history. And for its time, I can think of no other couple who really related to each other the way John and Abigail did. John treated his wife very much as an equal. She had a very, very active mind. She was well-read. She had read John Locke at the ripe old age of 13 or 14 and could quote it verbatim. It very impressed John on their first meeting. And he relied on her for advice. And I've said this many times, that if you go through the history of Adams's career as a lawyer, as an ambassador to Europe, and as a president, you'll see that those times when he is separated from Abigail by distance and time, he tends to fall into bad habits of character, making very rash decisions, whereas Abigail was always a kind of tempering factor for him. And that was one of the things that we tried to bring out in the series, because the story of American history, the story of politics, is not about these great events that happen. It's about the people who make them happen and how their relationships with each other really determine their course in life.
One of the things that I found so interesting was the political education of John Adams at the hands of Benjamin Franklin, among other things.
John comes into the Continental Congress with the Massachusetts delegation, which includes John Hancock and his cousin Sam Adams, very much as the bull in the china shop. The Massachusetts delegation is being looked at as a group of firebrands who are going to bring the whole house crashing around everybody. And that's very much what John Adams does in the early days, until Benjamin Franklin takes him aside and essentially explains to him that you have to be a lot more subtle in politics, that you cannot simply lecture to people and harangue them. You have to win them to your side. And this is a valuable lesson that he learns from Franklin and has to relearn from Franklin when he becomes our ambassador to France. And he becomes once again this innocent abroad who is shocked by French culture, unable to believe the fact that he can't get an audience with the king at Versailles, that Franklin has made a celebrity of himself. And he has to learn that lesson all over again.
It's interesting, too, because the series gives you an opportunity to really think about the formation of American identity, the formation of New England identity as distinct from English identity. And John Adams, a couple of different times during the series, talks about himself kind of consciously as a New England man.
Correct.
Both the kind of limitations and the reality of what that is.
One of the misperceptions that we tried to correct in making the show was this idea that in the late colonial period, America and England already had separate identities. That's not correct. What made the decision to declare ourselves independent so difficult and so painful for so many was these were not Americans suddenly deciding we're going to become independent of the King of England. These were British Americans who were severing all ties with their mother country and with all of their kinsmen abroad. Very, very different situation. And when people in colonial America talked about country, they didn't talk about America. They talked about Massachusetts or Virginia. John Adams says in our first episode, Massachusetts is my country. And that's how people felt. There were sectional differences. There remain sectional differences in America. I think that that's very much embedded in the American character, that we are regional in our thinking. And that was certainly true of the founding generation. And what made those men, and they were all men, by the way, Abigail was not a direct part of any of this, what made them so remarkable was the fact that they could set aside those regional differences for the time it took them to decide the greatest questions of the age.
And the way they came to those decisions was through argument and debate and more argument and more debate and politics and the process by which that happens. I mean, we sometimes, I think, put kind of rosy lenses on our founding fathers, but the fact is that as much as we're arguing now, they were arguing then.
They were arguing then, and they were much more confrontational. As strange as that may sound, they were much more confrontational. They were much more physical. I'd like to call our second episode about the debates for independence Colonial CNN, because you really get a chance to see how rough those arguments were. And it wasn't all principled discussion. There was messy compromise. In the days and hours before a vote was going to be taken on independence, John and Sam Adams and Benjamin Franklin went to the wavering delegations to see what deals could be struck in order to get people to vote for independence, or at least not impede the vote for independence. New York would not stand in the way if Pennsylvania could be delivered by Adams and his men. South Carolina, which had opposed the vote for independence, turns around saying we will vote for independence as long as there are no dissenters. And so when the vote finally comes on July 2nd, yesterday, not tomorrow, July 4th, which is when the Declaration of Independence was promulgated, when that decision arrives, it is not a unanimous vote in every sense. It is a 12-0 vote, with New York abstaining, waiting specific instructions from a newly elected legislature.
Meanwhile, there was a Quaker faction, which is a deep part of the history of our country, which both then and then we see it again during the Civil War and we see it all throughout our history, is trying to find ways to solve problems peacefully.
Right. Your listeners obviously know that the Quaker faith is really based on the principle of pacifism, and they are aggressive in their defense of pacifism, one might say. This creates tremendous animosity in the early days of the Second Continental Congress, because you have John Adams and his contingent from Massachusetts, remember, who are Puritans. And the Puritans have not had the best of relationships with the Quakers in Massachusetts. In fact, they're accused of Quaker massacres. So John Dickinson, who is Adams' leading opponent in the Second Continental Congress, is a Quaker from Pennsylvania who believes that the sole intention of the Massachusetts delegation is what we would now call a rush to war. And he says at one point, if you continue to lead the Congress in this fashion, we will walk away from this Congress and we will walk away from any union that you declare. Ultimately, Dickinson delivers a profoundly moving speech, of which we only have snippets in the historical record, advocating that we remain part of Britain, looking 100 years in the future, and quite accurately predicting civil war, among other catastrophes that would befall us. But he was a worthy opponent to Adams, and it must be said for Dickinson as a Quaker that when independence was declared and a Pennsylvania militia was formed, he was the first man to sign up. And in fact, on the 4th of July, he led troops to join Washington in Boston.
We're talking to Kirk Ellis about John Adams. John Adams the man, John Adams the book, John Adams the movie series that you worked on, that you wrote. Now, you talk about the historical record, and when you do a series like this, it must be such an interesting process of working with the documents that have come down to us and the artistic license that you have to take when there's not complete information there, and just the necessities of creating a drama that people want to watch.
Well, one of the beauties of actually working on this particular subject is the fact that John Adams left an amazing record of his life in his writings, including a diary that he kept when he was a very, very young man. And we know what John Adams was thinking almost throughout his life. What he was thinking, why he was thinking, who he was thinking it about, how his opinions changed, and that's rare. And because this was a culture that valued the written word so much, we have quite literally miles of microfilm letters between him and Abigail, him and Thomas Jefferson later in life, his own journal entries of the Continental Congress, other people's. I mean, it was a massive research project that took the better part of 3 years to assimilate all that information. And that's what creates the complexity of the character. Adams is a wonderful person for a modern audience to follow for the 8-plus hours of the miniseries because he has all of these shadings. He's a man of principle. He's a man of principle, but yet there's always an undercurrent of vanity in determining what course an action may or may not take. He's somebody who loves his wife and children, yet spends a good part of his life and a good chunk of their early marriage living somewhere else. He is ultimately estranged from his middle son, who dies an embittered alcoholic at the age of 30 on the eve of Adams losing the election to Thomas Jefferson in 1800. So there are all of these wonderful pieces that you can bring out in the character. And when you have an actor like Paul Giamatti, he really knows how to hone in on those individual beats where they can be the most impactful.
He really was such a perfect choice for that role.
Paul was hired, I didn't know this at the time, Paul was hired by HBO on the basis of the 4-minute monologue he delivers expounding on the glories of the Pinot Noir grape in Sideways. And when I heard that, it made perfect sense because clearly you would want an actor in that role who would be able to hold the screen for minutes at a time with page after page of dialogue, standing before the Continental Congress to deliver his speech in favor of independence, as happened on the set, 55 times over the course of 3 days, and managing to get applause from his fellow cast members pretty much every time he gave it. So he really had the chops for that kind of role.
Talk about his relationship with Thomas Jefferson, because I think it's such a, first of all, interesting friendship, long-term relationship. They both died on the 4th of July, 50 years after the Declaration of Independence, 50 years after July 4th, 1776, which is miraculous,
That is correct. That is a true historical fact, as Jack Crabb says in Little Big Man, even though I was accused of inventing it by critics who hadn't done their homework when the miniseries first came out. Where to begin on that? Let me try to attack that chronologically. Adams doesn't actually know Jefferson personally until Jefferson arrives very late in the Second Continental Congress, right around the time that this whole movement for independence is really starting to build momentum. He has, however, read Jefferson's writings and knows him to be an ally in the cause of independence, but they are very, very different men. Adams is very in your face. His body language was always very direct. He would lean forward, you know, as he came to you. And he had that sort of, you know, pit bull intensity that people remember about him, that many people would find irritating about John Adams. Jefferson was just the reverse. Jefferson had a unique ability throughout his life to blend into any wall he might be sitting next to. His body language was always described as being all elbows and knees, very angular, slouching in chairs, doing everything he could to look inconspicuous, because he did not relish this idea of being a public figure. But in the early days of their association, Jefferson is very much Adams' protege. Adams picks him to write the Declaration of Independence, when many people thought it was Adams's right to do that because he had been so much the colossus on the floor of the Congress. But he recognized that he was unpopular with many parts of the Congress. He recognized that he was not the most felicitous writer, that Jefferson really had a way with words. And so he saw that talent. And they maintain a good relationship throughout a large chunk of their career. It all starts to go bad, really, during the Washington presidency, when Adams is vice president and very much a believer that throughout his life, that not only America, but men and mankind in general need strong governance, because without strong governance, people will simply give in to their own worst inclinations. That is a very Puritan attitude. Okay. Jefferson obviously had a different point of view. He believed in the eternal betterment of man. In the Washington presidency, they end up on opposite sides of this debate in government. And Adams sides with Alexander Hamilton and George Washington for the establishment of a public debt, of a national bank, many sort of what we would call now in our political discourse imperial decrees that go against the republicanism of Jefferson. And it becomes very embittered, to the point that there are accusations hurled back and forth by both camps in the election of 1800, still the dirtiest election on record. Say what you will about our current political climate, there is no election that was ever more dirtily fought than that particular election in terms of the propaganda that was unleashed on the unsuspecting public at the time. And it's Abigail who first decides that Jefferson is somebody who can't be trusted, is conspiring against her husband. And she doesn't really forgive Jefferson for what happens in the election. When it is later revealed in Jefferson's first term that he may or may not have had an affair with Sally Hemings, Abigail, I won't say necessarily relished that news, but she did say that, you know, the snake in the garden, you know, has finally, you know, been bitten. Right. And it's only many years later, in the wake of Abigail's death, that they begin corresponding again. And they realize that for all their differences, and Jefferson has never really held any animosity to Adams, and Adams is relieved to hear it, and they begin this correspondence where they find that they have so much more in common than they ever disagreed on. And their letters, which last almost up until the months before they both pass away, deal with things like the Missouri Compromise of 1820, with slavery, a question Jefferson never answers properly in Adams's view. And remember, Adams is the only one of the founders who has no connection to the slave trade at all, doesn't own slaves, and is not involved in any of that economy.
And is ideologically against it.
Totally against it. Totally against it. Abigail at one point asks her husband in a letter, you know, could our current travails in this war be punishment for the sin of slavery?
Yeah. I think it's a really interesting question that is brought up during the film, is the question of what is revolution? Mm. What is the American Revolution? What is a revolution? What happens when the French have their revolution? What is the American relationship to it? And there's a moment, I think it's in the last episode, where John Adams says something like, you guys don't even understand what the meaning is. It's been lost.
Ah, yes. I mean, Adams and Jefferson both have, you could say, the good fortune or the misfortune to live to see many of the principles for which they worked become undone by the Jacksonian Revolution. You know, at that point, this is happening. John Quincy Adams is president.
That's John Adams' son.
Correct. And it's a much contested election. Many people thought that Andrew Jackson should have won that election. John Quincy, like his father, becomes a one-term president. He's defeated by Jackson in 1828. So neither Adams nor Jefferson lived to see that Jacksonian Revolution. But for all of their declarations of the freedom of man and the equality of man, there is an elitist view that they both have. And one thing that they are both terrified of is government in the hands of a mob with a demagogic leader. This is true of all of the founders. And that's what they see starting to happen in the America of the late teens and the early 20s of the 19th century. But the debate that they start really in their time in Europe, when they're both ambassadors, this idea of which government best suits us as a people. Should it be a government that has a strong executive with a legislative branch and an independent court to hold that executive in check? Or is it a weak executive with a strong legislature and a court and an executive to hold them in check? This is a debate we still have. I'm sure people tuning in to any radio station right now on talk radio will find this discussion going on. And it's a discussion they start knowing that it will go on in time and never find an answer, and that the balance will always shift between one and the other based on currents in American thinking and the American character over the centuries.
And based in what's actually happening and what people are fighting about.
That's correct. That's correct.
We're talking to Kirk Ellis, writer and co-executive producer of the HBO series John Adams, which, by the way, is going to be at the Jean Cocteau Cinema tonight. And the entire series will be shown over the course of three nights, tonight, Sunday, and Wednesday of next week. And I have to say, I mean, when you have that much space to do a television program, it's like being able to write a long book.
It is. It's a very novelistic way to approach your writing and your viewing. And this is slightly off topic of John Adams, but it brings to bear a new trend, I think, in contemporary television. More and more people are turning to limited series, whether that is a show like True Detective on HBO or the recently ended Fargo on FX, where they can get a really well-told story over 10 or 13 weeks that's closed-ended and then move on to the next one. And that's true of series like Breaking Bad, which you can argue is a 60-episode novel.
Right. Yeah. Or The Wire, which was a
exactly.
five-season, I don't know how many episode novel with an arc from beginning to end, and that's what you could do with this piece of history.
That's correct. We could not have told. I mentioned earlier that when I first read the book, it had been optioned for a four-hour miniseries on commercial television on CBS. So you're looking at basically a two-and-a-half-hour movie. You can't tell a story in the kind of detail that we could in a seven-part miniseries. You can't go into the complexities of the character. Time is your enemy in those kinds of structures. Whereas this allows you to spend time with people and let scenes and relationships play out. And really, we could stop the action dead in episode 4 in the garden of Adams's home outside Paris and have John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and Benjamin Franklin talk about what form of government America should have, knowing that there was this constitutional convention happening in Philadelphia for which only Franklin would be present. And nobody blinked an eye. There's just no way you could do that in a two-hour film. There's just no way. That'd be the first scene to hit the cutting room floor. And for many people, including our actor, Stephen Delane, who plays Thomas Jefferson, is absolutely wonderful. And I hope to have as a Skype guest for our performance on the 9th. That was his favorite scene to do in the whole miniseries.
Very interesting. Well, and it's great to watch because it gives us... I mean, I think, you know, people talk about the pace of life and how we're living in this Twitterverse and everybody's moving so quickly, but it seems to me that there is a real hunger that people have to slow down
Yes.
and think and actually have a long series like this in which to contemplate the roots of our nation.
It's exactly the reason you read a novel of a certain length, because you know you can spend time with it. I mean, how many of us have dived into a really good book, and we get very attached, and we get very involved in the characters and in the storytelling, and we could finish it in a couple of days, but we decide to stretch it out over a week just because we want to have it to go back to. That's why I could never binge a series. I couldn't watch all 13 episodes of House of Cards, for instance. I'll do two a session.
Right.
And then split them up over a week so that I've got something to go back to. That's the way people watch John Adams and apparently continue to do so.
Very interesting. So let's go back to this question of revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And it is intimately connected with, I think, England and France, who were continually at odds with each other, and the United States, before it became the United States and then after it was the United States, was continually negotiating that, and who are we supporting and who are we asking for support from?
This idea of American exceptionalism plays into this. Much as we would like to think differently, for so much of our early history, America was simply not important to so much of the world, except as what we were doing on our shores impinged on any of their activities. And clearly that was what seemed at the time the eternal battle between the English and French, I should say the British and French empires, for control of the world. And France becomes our ally in the war. And frankly, without the French naval assistance that we had, it would have been a very, very different outcome in all of this.
Namely, we might have lost the American Revolution.
It's very possible.
Yeah.
There are scholars who argue not so much that we won the revolution as the British lost it. And that's very true. We benefited from some truly incompetent military decisions on their side. What happens as a result of the French coming to America in 1778-1780, particularly the Marquis de Lafayette, who's a very young man who essentially becomes the surrogate son of George Washington for the time he's in the United States, he sees this idea of freedom and feels that it's something that can be exported to his country. But he's warned by Washington and others who are in his circle that America's a different place. America's a new country. It had not been colonized that long ago. France, on the other hand, was deeply, deeply embedded in a royal and clerical culture, and that you could not simply take the American Revolution and export it to France and see the same results. And of course, when it did happen, it resulted in the terror and the mass guillotining of people in the public square in Paris. This also becomes a major point of separation between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson is our ambassador to France in that time. And he writes famously, and I would also say notoriously, in a letter that the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of tyrants. This appalls John Adams, and he feels that Jefferson, in that sense, is betraying everything they stood for, that the revolution was not about a mob simply taking over and instituting another form of dictatorship, that there had to be rules, there had to be laws, there had to be principles. And this is something that they will continue to argue over the course of time. Jefferson in later years will admit to seeing that the bloodshed of the revolution had gone too far. But another one of his famous quotes that, you know, you can't go, you know, from a feather bed, you know, to a different kind of bedding overnight.
Well, and there's another aspect to all of it, which was that John Adams was sent on a diplomatic mission to France earlier, and he really didn't do very well, and the kind of New England man who didn't speak a word of French and who was somewhat puritanical in the way that he dealt with things like sensuality and stuff like that. I mean, he just was not a good fit and seemed not to like the place, and they didn't like him either.
That was the other thing that made John so attractive, because there was also a great deal of humor. He possessed a tremendous sense of humor, although not always about himself. And he did get himself into scrapes that can only be called comical. And you've just hit upon one of the great ones. Adams is dispatched by the Second Continental Congress to assist Franklin in Paris in obtaining what was called a Treaty of Amity and Commerce with France. We needed a piece of paper that would show Britain that we had the French on our side, even if there was no commitment of men or materiel. And Adams was dispatched to help Franklin get that. It takes him so long to cross the water and to make his way to France that by the time he gets there, the treaty has already happened. Franklin has already made this treaty happen. So Adams arrives and discovers on his first day that he now has absolutely no portfolio. There's really no job for him to do. So he creates a job for himself. And his job for himself is to get the king and to get the French government, particularly the Minister of State, the Comte de Vergennes, to hurry the hell up and start giving money, sending troops over. How long is this going to happen? And he pretty much alienates everybody he meets. He finds French culture licentious. He is flabbergasted and scandalized by Franklin openly carrying on with a woman who happens to be his next-door neighbor. And all of this just resonates badly with him. He's also envious of Franklin's celebrity. Franklin in Paris in the 1770s was Mick Jagger. His image was on plates. It was on coins. It was on buttons. There were the Franklin caps that were being worn by the French. One woman had a chamber pot with Franklin's image emblazoned on it, as she said to Franklin, "Because I wanted your face to be the first thing I see every morning when I wake up."
Good heavens.
So Adams was jealous. He was jealous of Franklin. And he made himself such a nuisance that the Congress ultimately rescinded his authority and sent him to Holland, where he was able to negotiate a $10 million loan in the darkest days of the Revolution that probably saved us from losing the battle.
Very interesting. And meanwhile, Benjamin Franklin was totally playing up the rustic American.
Correct.
With the coonskin cap and everything.
He was acting the part, and he said to Adams repeatedly, he says, "You must understand that in France they have an image of Americans, and if you want to get these results you're talking about, you need to play the part of an American." So he would put on his homespun, he would put on the cap, and he'd go out, and he spoke terrible French. Adams ultimately taught himself the language, as he did Dutch and German, and he spoke the language very well. But the French were totally amused by Franklin's bad accent. It was oh so charming.
We're talking to Kirk Ellis. Although, I mean, I guess it's kind of an obvious thing to say, I kept thinking during the movie that, you know, they were inventing all of this as they went along. When you look back on history, it's like, well, of course we won the war, and of course we became an empire, and then there was Manifest Destiny and all the good and bad that came along with that and everything else. But at the time, nobody had any idea really how it was going to go, and the kind of courage and just chutzpah that it took to say, we are inventing a new country with these new ideals and going to argue about them. I mean, it was huge.
It was called The Leap into the Dark. There's actually a very good book about this period by John Furling, another historian whose works I relied on in writing the script, called A Leap in the Dark. And it's this idea that it's always a pitfall when you're writing historical drama. You want to avoid situations where characters say, what we're doing is of historical importance, and America must listen to us. But when you look at the letters and the speeches that were made around this time, the word posterity crops up a lot. These men knew that what they were doing would seal the fate not only of their own generation, but of generations to come. That is why they had the debates that they did. That is why they agreed on as many of the points as they could agree. That is why, unfortunately, they left points on which they could not agree, like slavery, for another generation or two generations to sort out, because they knew there would be no agreement on that if they wanted to actually achieve their main goal of independence. So My own thinking about this is that we were very lucky in the timing. We would have had a different group of people arguing these cases 10 years, 20 years before, 10 years, 20 years after, and the results would have been very different.
And one of the things that would have been different, it was a rather secular period that we were going through at that time.
How do I phrase this delicately? The founders become fodder for people on both sides of the ideological aisle to talk about whether we are a Christian country, whether we're not a Christian country, the role of church versus state, all of those things. But as you've indicated, all of these men were products of the Enlightenment. They believed in the rationality of man. Their models were the Greek and Roman philosophers, John Locke, René Descartes, all of these great thinkers of the time. And while Sam Adams, in the very first Continental Congress, in order not to be a firebrand, stands up before the Congress, which immediately leans back, thinking they're going to get some kind of tirade, Sam Adams says, "I believe that in order to consecrate this event, it would be good to have a chaplain begin with the prayer." That's how prayer starts, you know, in our government. It really was Sam Adams attempting to be conciliatory, to say, hey, we understand that there are men of faith here. There were many ministers in the Continental Congress, the first two Congresses. And that was a way of, what do we call it now? Reaching across the aisle.
Right.
To do that.
It's interesting. I mean, you talk about the Enlightenment and the belief in rationality of man and things like that. And there's always the tension between that on the one hand and the fear of democracy and mob rule on the other hand, because that faith in human rationality doesn't really go that far.
Let me be clear on this point. We do not live in a democracy. We live in a representative republic. That is the government that John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and all the other founders set up for us, precisely because they believed that a true democracy, where literally everybody had a voice, everybody had an equal voice, okay, was a prescription for mob rule and what they called demagoguery, which was their number one fear. I think they were right. We've seen that fear borne out, you know, by major democratic movements, and we've certainly seen it borne out in what's happening around the world, you know, in our present day.
Right.
So for all of his democratic leanings, Jefferson never believed in a fully democratic government. He never thought about that. Remember, all of the people who are arguing these cases are privileged landowners, men of significant education. Only men could vote. Only property owners of a certain status could actually vote. Women were excluded. Blacks were excluded. Native Americans were excluded. Not only excluded, but being actively persecuted at the time. So our society didn't come from this belief that everybody had all the rights equal. Jefferson writes in his Declaration of Independence, we know that all men are created equal. Notice he uses the word men, okay? And all men are not created equal. That was his big debate with Adams, you know? I think the best way you can phrase the difference between Adams and Jefferson on this point is that they visited a French orphanage at one point. And with their wife, Abigail was there with John, and I believe that Jefferson had his daughter Patsy with him. And they take this tour, and at one point Jefferson looks out over this group of children and he says, "Isn't this a remarkable scene? Because all of these children have the same, you know, have the same opportunity." And Adams says, "That's not true. Their opportunity is going to depend on who adopts them, what happens to them later in life, what their fate is, and that it is in the nature of men that the more privileged, the more educated, the more popular are going to rise to the top. There's nothing we can do to stop that. All we can do is create a system of government in which the worst impulses are tamped down." That was the difference.
And it's interesting because when you look at the increasing democratization that has characterized the last couple of hundred years. I mean, African Americans did get the right to vote. Women did get the
right
to vote. Native Americans, I mean, who survived the genocide, have the right to vote. And can you imagine what would be the politics of this country today if the people who were making all the decisions were white male landowners?
Well, exactly. When you talk about constitutional amendments and you actually look at the, we're always being it's always being advocated to us that we have to read the Constitution, read the Constitution. Well, when you read it, what you discover is most of the amendments to the Constitution are about enfranchising people, not disenfranchising people. And the last one of those amendments is, of course, reducing the voting age from 21 to 18. So young people, that sort of last minority, are, you know, we're finally enfranchised. And the founders would approve of that because the Constitution was designed as this document that would be fluid. Look at the case that happened with Aereo versus the television networks, or with cell phones and search and seizure. Could Thomas Jefferson have foreseen cell phones? No, but he knew what an illegal search was. And
right.
So the right remains the same. Only the technology has changed. The principles in that document have not.
And so looking back, we see some of the progress that's been made, particularly in enfranchisement. And at the same time, we see some of the same arguments going on year after year, century after century, really, or one generation after another. Namely, you know, the North versus the South. Whether there should be more or less government, whether that government should be centralized or really in the hands of the states and local communities.
Right. And I think now you see another divide as well. I think you're also seeing East and West. You know, the West is this whole region, really the Trans-Mississippi West, but really the sort of Rocky Mountain West to the Pacific Ocean, is now becoming the crucible for so many different kinds of legislation, whether that's legalizing marijuana in Colorado and Washington State, or it's about the population growth, immigrant growth that will change, you know, red states to blue states over the course of time, and the whole danger that that creates, you know, for people who don't agree with those policies. We're seeing that as well. You know, why should New York, you know, dictate to Santa Fe? You know, or Los Angeles. We're seeing that as well. Again, and that goes back to what I was saying earlier, that as Americans, we have a national identity, but it seems that throughout history, our identity has been a regional identity.
Kirk Ellis is the Emmy Award-winning writer and co-executive producer of the HBO series John Adams. He's chair of the Santa Fe Arts Commission. He's vice president of the Western Writers of America. That's a new thing, I guess.
Recently elected, yes.
Yes.
The organization's been around for 50 years, but I'm the new vice president.
And the series John Adams will be screening at the Jean Cocteau Cinema tonight at 7 o'clock, and then Sunday and Wednesday, and all the different episodes will be screened over the course of those three
That's
nights.
That's correct. That's right.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe and wish you a happy 4th of July.
Yes, and to you and your listeners, Mary Charlotte. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.